Okay, so a couple pieces of business before we get started. I'm going to post a few problems for you guys from chapter 7. We'll have them due early next week, likely before class time on Tuesday. And then during class time on Tuesday next week, we'll set up your second mini project, which is due the following Friday. It's kind of your last assignment of the semester, except for the final itself, basically. So that will be largely an extension of the first mini project. First mini project, setting up the kinematics of those systems. We'll do something similar with actually dynamics, getting equations in motion, and simulating them. But we'll talk through that on Tuesday. So a week from today, we'll talk through that. This week, we're actually going to circle back and cover one section of Chapter 7. That we kind of glossed over briefly. I think it fits better here, kind of an introduction in Chapter 8 more than it does within Chapter 7. It's basically looking at constraint forces. And we're going to look at today, starting the beginning of setting up how to solve Lagrange's equations, set up Lagrange's equation when you have constraint forces or are using constrained generalized coordinates. So things change just a little bit, and there's several ways we can attack that that problem. All right, and then I'm aiming to have your exams on Thursday. I haven't looked at them in a whole lot of detail yet. So that's the goal. Okay, so let's look at section 7.4.2. That's the title, Constraint Forces and Conditions. So let's think about this a little bit. If you have a constraint force, which you kind of maybe more commonly heard called a reaction force, we're going to talk about them moving forward as constraint forces because they are forces that enforce constraints. That's typically how you hear reaction termed. So in a situation where you have a set of unconstrained generalized coordinates, define what that means first. What do we mean by unconstrained generalized coordinates? Anybody?
It's the minimum set to fully define it.
Yeah, it's the minimum set to fully define it, and in the case we have no non-holonomic constraints that are there. Right? So if you have non-holonomic constraints, you have to have, it is by definition, that you have to have a constraint set. So a minimum set, so in that case, what kind of work do constraint forces do any work? Do any virtual work? So constraint forces generally are non-conservative, but the question is, are they doing virtual work?
You consider them you don't consider them.
Right. Right, you don't consider them generally, and we don't consider them generally because they don't do any virtual work. If we have an unconstrained set of generalized coordinates. Right, and that's one of the strengths of using Lagrange's method, is we get to ignore those constraint forces if we're able to pick a set of unconstrained generalized coordinates. In Newton-Euler, you can't. You got to still consider them no matter what. Right. And that's one of the strengths of Lagrange's method. So, if you have unconstrained generalized coordinates, constraint forces do no virtual work. Okay. You can probably guess where I'm going with this. If you have a constrained set of generalized coordinates, what does that mean? If the set of generalized coordinates is, if we're saying it's a constrained set.
You would consider this.
Well, you can kind of guess the other side of this, but I'm asking, what does this really mean for those that set of generalized coordinates if we say they're constrained? Is the first question I'm asking. You have more generalized coordinates than you actually need.
Are the more than we need to fully define the system?
More than the number of degrees of freedom. Yes, which is what you would need to fully define the configuration of the system. Right. So there's some constraints. There's some relationship between that set of within that set of generalized coordinates. One, you could write one in terms of the other. So if you have that set of constrained generalized coordinates, then your constraint forces. String forces do virtual work, right? Because they are what forces are going to enforce the constraints you have embedded in your constrained set of generalized coordinates. Okay. So there are situations where we have to have constrained sets of generalized coordinates. If we have non-holonomic constraints, there's no way for us to get an unconstrained set that represents those guys, right? So we're going to have constrained coordinates, set generalized coordinates then, right? However, even in the case where we can write an unconstrained set of generalized coordinates for our system, sometimes we want to write the constrained set. We want to know what the forces are acting, what the constraint forces are, depending on, you know, there's certain, we might want to know the forces at a pen or something like that to be able to prescribe what kind of material I need that pen to be or something. Okay, so there's two ways we can get at that. We can solve the unconstrained set, and then based on the motion of that point, we know that. We know the MA side of the equation. We can figure out what the force is. Right? Or we can write a constrained set of generalized coordinates and solve for the force in line at the same time. Okay. So let's talk about how we're going to define, in the second case, what kind of work those generalized forces are doing. All right. So let's define, this notation is a little bit cumbersome, but hang with me, and I'll describe the terms as we get them up here. Let's understand that. So we're going to call this is going to be the contribution, make sure I get this in the right order, of the ith constraint to the jth generalized coordinate. Okay. Or you can think about it as the jth generalized force, even. All right. So what we're going to do is set up where the, you know, the QJs we had before are going to end up being some kind of QJ, we're going to write apply plus RJ I's. It's kind of summation like that. Okay. We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Okay. So again, I'm probably going to end up dropping these parentheses because I'm going to do it by mistake and we'll stick with it. So again, the contribution of the ith constraint and the forces resulting from that to the jth generalized force. So J depends on the number of coordinates we have. Ith just depends on the number of constraints we have. So let's write, let's drop out to configuration space for a second. We can write our generalized forces as kind of this Q hat, which is effectively like a vector of generalized forces in that configuration space. Well, we can then write some kind of R hat in that same space for the ith constraint get in. And that's a hat on the end too. And what this equation really is all this equation is doing as we just talked about all that's really showing is a portion of that generalized force vector, if you will, that's coming from the ith constraint. Okay. So just largely defining kind of terms and notation so far. So given this kind of general setup, okay, let's select a virtual displacement. A virtual display delta r that's consistent with our constraint equation in this case. And what that really means, we're just kind of talking generally right now. Consistent with the constraint. If it's consistent with the constraints, right, what that means for us is that it has to be to perpendicular to the normal, right? Let's forget that piece. Has to be perpendicular to this vector AI, which is the normal direction of the Jacobian constraint coefficient. Finish that off. And we'll, if you don't remember what those Jacobian constraint coefficients are, we'll review that in just a second. Okay. Well, if those guys are perpendicular, what is that?
Zero.
Zero, right? Okay. Okay. Well, then, what is that based on what we said over here? That motion is consistent, doesn't violate this constraint. What reactions are there? If I have a particle, imagine it's supposed to follow this line, right? And by definition, it's following this line. What kind of reaction forces are acting on it? My delta R is right along that line. Okay, let me ask another way. I have this curve. I have this collar, right? If I look at virtual displacement of this guy in that direction, right, I have some constraint forces because they're forcing it onto this, onto that bar that it's supposed to follow, right? But if I have some virtual displacement that's exactly following that bar, does that force have to act? My kinematical description of the collar exactly matches the curvature of the bar. Do those constraint forces have to act?
No.
No. Right? So, in this case, That guy's 0-2. Okay. And these two things are true for any delta r here. All right, remember, that's just, we kind of just made up this motion. So it's just consistent with the constraint. So it's actually infinitely many delta r's, virtual displacements, that would satisfy both these equations. Right. But in order to satisfy both of them, what we're saying, or what is true, is that that has to be true. Right? Both of these things are true. This has to be true. Right. Well, what does that tell us? Well, if they're parallel, right, and they're vectors, all that's changing is their magnitude. Right. So then we can write or you might see it the other way generally. Sorry. That. So the parallel, they're the same direction, just some scaling factor between them. Their magnitude has changed, direction is the same. Okay. This might look familiar if you have some linear algebra skills. Or I guess some Diffie-Q skills too. That lambda I is called a Lagrange multiplier. I knew I was going to do that. How about that? The lower script on I got me. On A. Convinced me to switch there. Sorry. Sorry about that. Thanks for pointing it out. Okay. So that gets us to, if we can do this in the constraint configuration space, well, we can actually extend that out, and the book goes into it in some kind of detail, where the same thing holds over here if we're writing it just in terms of our generalized coordinates, even if we're not in this configuration space. Okay, so the same thing holds over there. If we write in the coordinate space. So we can write R, J, I, and we're out of the configuration space, so we can leave our hat behind. In this case, same thing happens here, which gets us to that. Okay. What that does for us, and it's not immediately obvious now, it probably won't be until we get to an example in a little bit, it allows us to write the contribution of my constraint forces just as some multiplier times that Jacobian coefficient, right, which we can get these just by knowing the form, the general form of the velocity constraint. And we can pick those right out of that equation easily. So we end up knowing what these forces are without having to go through the whole virtual work that they're doing, which is generally easier for us. Okay. So really all of that was to set up that I can do this,
basically.
Okay. And some support for maybe why that works. This section of the book, like we kind of talked through earlier when we first started looking at Lagrange, there is a lot of text explanation of what's going on here, some intuition you can build. And because it's a book, it's able to go into a lot more detail than we can just in lecture. So I would encourage you, if you haven't been, to start reading these chapters, even if you weren't reading the earlier ones, or if you have been reading, to continue reading. And the same will be true in chapter 8. There's multiple pages of text discussion per set of equations, if you will, that I think is helpful. Okay. So remember that for now. What this doesn't really tell us, though, is kind of what is the actual constraint force acting in some way. Right? This gives us a contribution to a generalized coordinate or generalized force, right? But doesn't really give us the actual physical force as it's acting. Okay? There may be some cases where we want to know that. That's all right. Okay, so in that case, we can take this formulation and kind of twist it to our needs to figure out exactly what a constraint force, how it's acting. So let's look at that case. And then we'll get to hopefully some examples. So if you want to know really what the actual constraint force is, rather than just using this multiplier force, we are going to need to evaluate the virtual work that it does. Okay? So let's think about, let's define some vector, EI, let's define in the direction in which the motion is limited by the constraint. So the ith constraint force must be in that direction. Right? If I'm limiting motion in that, I can't move in this direction, I'm limiting motion necessarily in that direction. So we can write that as some unknown, right? The magnitude of CI is unknown. And that's the constraint force magnitude. And generally, that's going to be as large as it needs to be to enforce that constraint. And we don't know that ahead of time, generally. Okay. So, let's say, look at the virtual work done by this ith constraint force. And we can look at the virtual work force. It's going to be a J, right? Yeah. CIJ, QJ. Delta QJ, right. Okay. All this is really saying, virtual is a linear combination of the contributions in each direction. I guess I should put that. All right, so just like we can write this out, and we're trying to pick out that Q term for the unconstrained case, this is just that, but for the constrained case. Okay. And in fact, we can look at this and take, well, hey, that's actually going to be equal to this guy. And I guess more strictly, we can include that summation there too, since we have n generalized coordinates. So QJ, CI, jeez, sorry. That to be true. So what this gives us is the contribution of this constraint force to my generalized forces, QJ, right? Just by matching up terms like we did for an unconstrained force. Okay. So we find then that RJI ends up being that. Again, just by kind of matching up terms, and if we look, again, I've defined this, the jth, our reaction constraint force on the jth generalized constraint force component of the jth generalized force from the ith constraint is that. Again, just by matching up terms like we did for the unconstrained case, the external forces. Okay. Well, as we saw before, this is also equal to, put it in a different color, right? From our previous board. Okay. So we can get some expression from that for the magnitude of that constraint force is. Or we can rewrite that this way, just collecting terms. So from this, we can get the magnitude of that constraint force if we want to get it. And the kind of rub here is that this is going to be kind of specific to the system you're looking at. All right, this is, I mean, it's not so easy to generalize out beyond. Okay. All right. So that's all a little bit abstract so far. So let's look at a kind of simple example and look at a couple of different cases of it. All right. That I hope will clarify for you. We're still in the same section. Let me draw up our system. Okay. It's going to be a pretty simple one, but does work to illustrate these points. So we have two particles, and we'll call them, space in here, A and B. They're connected via a rod of length L. Okay. And they're constrained to this plane. Okay. So what's a good set of generalized coordinates to describe the system? XY and some angle. XY of what?
A.
XY of A. So I couldn't choose, perhaps. XA. YA. Some angle. What else can I choose? I could do some kind of R. R and phi, maybe, since we already got a theta to A and something else, right? Okay. But we have 3 degrees of freedom. Right, so an unconstrained set of generalized coordinates, we need 3, which is the case you guys are picking up. So let's look at that first. So I will note, the text of the book has this guy as phi throughout. The figure has this theta. So if you see that difference in the book, it's compared to our notes, just I'm going to stick with theta. I started working it before I read the textbook stuff in detail. So I have theta throughout, and decided to stick with that. So just swap out theta and phi in the book if you want to follow this in the book. Okay, so this set of generalized coordinates is what kind of set in terms of what we've been talking about so far? Constrained or unconstrained? Unconstrained, right. So this is an unconstrained set. Okay. And what I really want to look at is kind of start setting up where the equations of motion here. Okay. So if I want to do that, what do I need to do? I'm trying to set up some equations of motion, maybe. All right. And I'm going to encourage us, we're going to walk down. I'll set it up since we're doing it a little bit unique. Yeah. I want to consider, let's start out by considering these two guys as just separate particles for now. We have no gravity, we have anything, so really, if we consider these guys separate, what do we have acting on them? We can consider them separate bodies.
There's something keeping them together.
Yeah, there's something that's enforcing that they stay L apart. Right? So there's some kind of internal forces that usually we get to ignore. Right? So there's some kind of force, there's my directions, holding these guys together. That's a constraint making L constant. Right? Usually we get to ignore it. If we choose a set, we're going to get to ignore that if we want. Right, let's look at why we get to ignore that. Okay. So I have this set of generalized coordinates. Right? And if I define xb and yb on the position of b. Okay. I need to know, right? I want to write the virtual work that f is doing. Right. We'll have f in some kind of radial direction. And let's define that frame. We're actually going to make that a ER was R theta. So we'll stick with the books. Matching those to what the book picked out. Not necessarily what I chose here, but we'll follow Dr. Ginsburg. Okay. So, virtual work from that force acting on point A, right, which it is an F in the minus ER direction, which we can resolve that if we have to, times the virtual displacement of point A. Right? Okay. Well, we also have this force acting on body B. Right? So that virtual displacement point B. That's the virtual work we have going on in this system. Right, we don't have any other forces acting right now. And so if we're going to evaluate that, we need to be able to get to both of these displacements. Right? Okay. The delta RA one, pretty easy, I think. Well, how do we get to the delta RB, the virtual displacement of B? Yeah, that's kind of what the book calls a kinematical method. So you write the velocity of B. What's the velocity of B? Leave it like that for right now. All right, we know relative to point A, this is just kind of the component from the rotation. So relative to the point A, B is just L theta dot in the E theta. So we're just going to leave it like that for now. Okay, so I have this guy. What do I do with this now? If I'm trying to get to... So I can write, take all these velocity terms, do that way. All right, so you take just the velocities and replace with the vectors, and actually that ends up not being a vector then. So if I take this guy and just plug it in back up here, what am I left with? Well, this guy and that guy cancel, right? So it's kind of this and that cross product. So I just end up with the cross product there. What is that? Yeah, they're zero because they're perpendicular. So given this constrained set or unconstrained set of generalized coordinates, that constraint force does no virtual work. That's all we just showed. It's kind of a simple case backing up the kind of general stuff we just talked about. Everybody kind of follow that procedure? Should look a little bit familiar, hopefully. Okay. I'm going to erase this so I can stay over here and kind of out of the way of the board. I feel like I blocked the board when I'm over on that side. Okay. So that's case one we saw with this unconstrained set of generalized coordinates. Our constraint force, in this case we're calling F, does no virtual work. Okay. You can probably guess we're about to do. Let's call it case two, maybe. Okay. I'm going to say, well, hey, let's pick a different set of generalized coordinates. Okay. What kind of set generalized coordinates are these? We'll call this set. XA, YA, XB, YB. Yeah, it's constrained. Okay. So we have this constrained set of generalized coordinates. What that means is there's some constraint that dictates their relationship. Okay. In this case, what is that? How we would, yeah, something about L, right, dictates how far those things can be apart. How can we get write some constraint that represents that?
Like XB is going to be equal to XA plus L cosine theta. It's like, is that what you mean? Like, how do we get, how do we write XB in terms of things we already have? And YB?
Not quite. I mean, that would lead you to what I'm asking for. But we want to write the constraints in the kind of the form we talked about. I guess it's been 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago now. Right. So I want to be able to write the constraint equation in some form that's a combination, hopefully a linear combination of the generalized coordinates. Right. So in this case, I can recognize that, hey, I basically, I have a right triangle here. Right. Use Pythagorean theorem, I can say, well, the constraint, configuration constraint then, let me written that way. And I think you start going down the road you were going down, you could get to this. You end up with sine squares and cosine squares and things like that. Okay. So this is actually a configuration constraint, right? It's a constraint on the configuration, the locations of things. Right. What kind of form of constraint do we generally want to work with?
Velocity
constraints, as we prefer. Right. So I can just take the total time derivative of this guy, right, and get it into a velocity constraint form, right, which I will do. So I take total time derivative of the whole thing. There you go. So there's that constraint, and I can get rid of the twos if I want. There's that constraint in velocity form. Even further than that, I'd like to write it, right, where basically I have guys, 1, 2. I like to write it that way, because as we saw the first part of class today, if I know these guys, and I can know the contribution of that constraint force to my equations of motion. In this case, we find that so now I have those Jacobian constraint coefficients. Okay. So that's kind of just a, in this case, a little bit of an aside, just so you can kind of see how you would get those pre-geo constraints. All right. So now I want to look again. At the virtual work done by this constraint force. And it's still going to be that as it was before. The difference is, though, based on how we define these variables, these guys are now independent. Right? We have this constraint set, so we need to write delta RA delta XA, right? Yes. Because what we've done by defining our variables this way, right, our constraints of our generalized coordinates, is I have a way I have to use these guys to write my virtual displacement. I can't assume there's any kind of relationship between the two now. And that's kind of one of the differences here in this solution. Right, so in the first case, because we had that unconstrained set, you kind of had to assume that relationship, right, in order to enforce the kinematic constraint we've included. In this case, we have the constraint set. We're going to have that force acting, right? So we can assume the motion is matching the kinematic constraint any longer. It's the force, because we're going to have this force that is forcing it there, rather than the kinematics of the situation forcing it. Okay. So if we look at it this way, skip a little bit of math for you. Okay, so there we have some expression for virtual work. What's left to do? What's kind of wrong about this at the moment, if you will? Yeah, theta, right? So I need to write this completely in terms of the virtual displacements of my generalized coordinates, right? So theta is actually dependent upon these, right? So I know, and this is kind of where your constraint comes in, sine theta is, which way does it go? Yeah. That, I can plug those things in over there. That. And now I take, and we can match terms just like we did for any external force, like we did for the unconstrained cases. Right? So we also know, hey, that this guy is R, this is going to be 1, 1. Make sure I'm getting this order right before you copy it down. or rather the notation, not necessarily the order. Always find this notation a little bit cumbersome. Yes. Okay. So then we just take and match up what's multiplying each rotational displacement to get the contribution from that constraint force to each set of generalized forces in that direction. Alright, so I'll write those out quickly. So what we see in this case is that, hey, we have terms that are going to show up from the constraint force in the overall generalized force because, hey, that constraint force is doing work here, doing virtual work here, now that we have a constraint set of generalized coordinates. And if we think back, it's off the board now. We had earlier, let's see if I can get that expression again, that RJI right? Well, we can look at that and see, well, kind of for every generalized coordinate, the same CI shows up, right? F's in all of these guys, right? So then we know that, which, hey, that's exactly what we started with. So that makes some sense, hopefully. Okay. And then you can back up the terms for what each one of the CIJs are. So, pretty simple example, two cases, unconstrained. In the constrained set, kind of one difference, you have to evaluate the variables kind of independently. You can assume that they have kinematic relationships any longer, right? And then you end up with constraint forces that are doing virtual work, and then therefore would show up in the generalized force side of the equation when you do Lagrange's equation. Let's look at what this means for Lagrange's equation. Which is the beginning of chapter 8. Constrained generalized coordinates. Okay. And really, talking about today is Lagrange's equations for constrained coordinates, which is the first subsection of that chapter. Okay. So we've seen this constrained case. I can write the velocity constraints, possibly plural, on my system. Aij, Qj naught plus equal to zero. Or J constraints. So I can write velocity constraints or configuration constraints in the velocity constraint form like this, where I have those Jacobian constraint coefficients multiplying generalized coordinate velocities plus bi, which also can be a function of time. Okay. So I can write the constraints in this form. Okay. Let's look at what we said. Well, hey, for those n different generalized coordinates, I had generalized forces. Acting on each of them. Okay. Let's split this definition of generalized force into two pieces. You can probably guess what those two pieces are going to be. Kind of previewed it already. We're going to have some kind of component of it from the applied forces, right? External forces and torques, etc., plus some kind of component from the constraint forces. Okay. And to write just an Rj here rather than that full summation, because if you're looking at kind of virtual work, right, it's just a scalar combination of the things. Right. So this is just the sum of those in the jth direction that we saw before. Right. So the evaluation of that sum ends up being there. We also saw that, hey, we can write Rji like that. Okay. And this is just the sum of those guys, the work that those guys are doing in the jth direction again. So what does that do for us? Well, if you take this then and plug this into what we had for Lagrange's equation before, we can immediately see how to evaluate that, right? So we have d qj dot j applied plus, and I will write the summation this time. We'll use the Lagrange multipliers. That's y to j. Sorry. Because you have j constraints, each one of them is I. Capital J constraints. So you have the j cycles over your n generalized coordinates, the small j. The I cycles over your j number of constraints. In this case, the j. Those up there. Okay. So what we've done, if we have, for using constrained coordinates, we effectively have to consider this extra term that we haven't had to consider before. Right. And what we've covered so far today is hopefully setting up some understanding for why that ends up showing up, and then how to start getting to those terms and understanding, including those constraint forces. Okay. You guys with me so far? Questions? Questions? Okay. Here we go. 130. Let's look at a case where we would need to include some constraint force, right? Even if we might be able to evaluate our equations without it. So let's look at a system. And you'll see where these forces start showing up. So in this particular system we have, we looked at a version of this already one time before. Think. Linkage over here, there's actually collar. And there, both of these guys are length L. There is a spring between them. It's K. Let's define BC. We have some kind of moment acting over there. Okay. And let's pick two angles. Those guys should be level. There. Okay. This problem looks familiar, maybe? We forget whether we worked this one or not. So we worked this case before. There's an example in your book that works this case, if we didn't work it in class. And looks at this and considers this a perfect frictionless slider. Okay. Well, that's not going to happen ever. So we're always going to have some friction, right? Well, in order to consider that friction, right, what do I need? If I'm going to model this frictional force here as just Coulomb friction, what do I need to know? Of course, I'm going to need to know that, sure. That's a part of it. What else do I need to know?
Force acting down on the bar.
Yeah, I need to know particularly the normal force there. All right. Because this friction is proportional to those two things and always in direction opposed to motion, right? So in this case, I'm going to need to include this normal force in my solution because I need it to be able to figure out F. So let's do that. Okay. If it's not friction, if you didn't have this friction here, you can solve this. It's 1 degree of freedom. Right? Because these two guys are related based on the lengths being equal in the setup and the configuration. But because we need to know N, let's consider them independent. Okay. So we're going to pick, in this case, spring set of generalized coordinates. This theta and phi. Okay. I have a constraint then on those two equations. Configuration constraint that's true. All right. I could write that velocity constraint if I want. All right. So I have some forces over here. Let's ignore the moment for right now. And let's just worry about the friction. We're trying to figure out the contribution to the virtual work from the friction. Right. And because we need to include the normal force in that, we'll include the normal force. They're both acting at point C. Let's consider this point is the only point of contact between those two. Okay. So what we need to evaluate, virtual work kind of at C, if you will, is what? Well, it's the friction force. Right. What direction is that friction force acting?
Based on this, it would be acting the opposite, like some geometric moment going going that way, so then C would be traveling to the left, so the friction would be going towards the right.
Okay, in the general case, which direction is acting? Which true for all time?
The opposite direction that C is traveling.
Okay, so how do we write that? That. All right. The sign of this, I'm always opposed to the direction of the velocity. All right. And it's acting at point C. All right. Well, I also have the normal force there. Normal force we can define. Sorry, I should have trying to make sure we get through this today. Skipping steps, I tell you guys not to skip. Sorry. Okay. Well, the normal force is always in the positive J direction, but it also acts so the contribution of those two forces that are acting at the same point. What's the magnitude of F, if you think about it? So for us, as we've written it, U and with that. Okay. So I need to know this guy, right? How do I get to that? I can write the velocity of point C. Sure, I could, and actually the book does it via the analytical method, they call it in this case. I'll just skip to writing it since we were kind of running out of time. Just pick it up, so keep looking. And so then,
delta phi at the end.
Delta phi, yes. Okay. So then we can evaluate terms there and then match to that. And of course, we would, if we're including the moment over here, that needs to get included in the total work. Right? But you end up matching terms, and you can get the contribution of both of those normal force and the friction force to generalize forces in theta and phi. Okay. And the key point here is that, well, I had to include n in order to know what f is. So I was kind of forced, in this case, to have a constrained set of generalized coordinates so that n would show up. Allow me to evaluate the friction force. So that's kind of, it's quite often, if we end up dealing with friction, we're going to have some constrained set in order to know what the normal forces are that are causing, that are influencing that friction. And then the other case we'll see moving forward is, again, non-holonomic constraints. Okay.